Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear the English expression teaching series, Words and Their Stories, in which Ana Mateo explains terms that may or may not relate to food and eating. Later, Bob Doty, Shep O'Neill, and Tony Riggs bring us the latest in the ongoing American history series, Making of a Nation, this time examining the presidency of Andrew Johnson. But first, the Higher Education Report gives us a look at the future of student reporters and student-run newsrooms at colleges and universities across the United States. With a name like the Daily Orange, you might think the Syracuse University student-run newspaper prints a new issue every day. The newspaper began operating at the Syracuse, New York-based school in 1903. It has trained generations of reporters since. But the Daily Orange only prints a new issue 3 times a week. Editor-in-Chief Haley Robertson worries about where she will find companies willing to pay for advertising space. She also worries about having to fire friends. And she searches out former students willing to donate money so the newspaper can send reporters on the road to cover the university's sports teams. Media executives, many years older than Robertson, are facing similar problems. The news industry's financial difficulties have spread to colleges and universities across the United States.
College journalism educators are changing the way they teach to ensure what their students are learning remains useful in an ever-changing media environment. After several hard years for the industry, there are signs that conditions for future journalists might be improving. President Donald Trump's repeated criticism of reporters as enemies has influenced the next generation. Enrollment in journalism programs has grown, just as it did in the 1970s, after former President Richard Nixon was linked to illegal activities. Young journalists train for the future in 2 main ways. They receive a traditional classroom education from professors. They also put what they learn to use in student-run newsrooms. Chris Evans is president of the College Media Association, or CMA. He notes that few college newspapers have shut down the way local newspapers in towns and cities across the country have. But some have had to cut the number of times they publish each week.
A CMA study from earlier this year showed that 35% of school papers say they have reduced the number of times they release a print issue each week. 5% are fully internet-based. Half of the newspapers that have not gone internet-only, like the Daily Orange, say they are not printing as many copies. Maddie Arrowwood is the editor-in-chief of the University of North Carolina's Daily Tar Heel. The newspaper moved to 3 days a week in 2017 when its directors realized they were almost out of money, she says. The newspaper cut the pay of workers and moved into a smaller office. The Daily Tar Heel is now testing out publications aimed at people with special interests. Its reporters are trying to reach off-campus readers and advertisers by covering news in the surrounding community of Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Struggling with a $280,000 debt, the Hilltop newspaper at Howard University in Washington, D.C., printed its first edition of the school year in October. The Maneater at the University of Missouri used to print twice a week, then once. Now it is down to once a month. It operates separately from a newspaper run by professors and students that covers the town of Columbia. Editor Leah Glasser says the Maneater now charges workers yearly dues. In other words, they must actually pay money to work there. They can avoid the dues if they find a former student to support them or sell enough advertising to cover it.
It's so difficult to hear. We don't have enough money, Glasser told the Associated Press. We hear that a lot. As a generation, that doesn't make us turn around and go home. Newspapers like the Daily Orange and Daily Tar Heel do not take money from the university or fellow students. The newspapers believe that represents a conflict of interest. However, most student newspapers do receive this kind of financial support. Many journalism educators have at some point wondered to themselves, am I preparing young people for a dying industry? The University of North Carolina reports that newspaper newsroom jobs across the country dropped from 52,000 in 2008 to 24,000 today. There are other kinds of jobs in the field, of course, but not a very high number of them. But educators also say journalism schools do more than just prepare students for possible media jobs, said Marie Hardin. She is dean of Penn State's Donald Belisario College of Communications. She said journalism students learn communication, critical thinking, and writing. Such skills are highly sought in many different kinds of jobs. I'm Dorothy Gundy.
And I'm Pete Musto.
Now, it's time for Words and Their Stories, a program from VOA Learning English. Each week, we tell the story of words and expressions used in American English. Some are old, some are new. Together, they form the living and always changing language of the American people. To say that language is living is a figure of speech. Languages are always changing, so we say they are living. It does not mean that language needs air to breathe and food to eat, but you and I do. And eating involves several actions: biting, chewing, and swallowing. Now, sometimes when we are hungry, we may eat too fast or too much. We may, in fact, bite off more than we can chew. We take a big bite and then have a hard time breaking down or swallowing the food. This can lead to a really unpleasant feeling. We have eaten more than our body can take at one time. The result is not good. We may feel sick. Well, the same thing can happen in other situations besides eating. With many things, you can figuratively bite off more than you can chew. The expression biting off more than you can chew means to take on too much. You agree to do more than you actually can. I think it is safe to say that we have all been there. For example, you really want to do something, or you want to prove something to yourself or others. So you accept responsibility for a project. What is the problem there, you might ask? Well, the project might be much too difficult or complex for one person, but you think you can do it on your own. You, my friend, have just bitten off more than you can chew. We have other terms and expressions that mean about the same thing. You could say that you have taken on more than you bargained for. You have taken on too much. You have overextended yourself. Another great expression that means the same is this one. You have spread yourself too thin. This is visually quite interesting. If you can imagine yourself being pulled in different directions until you become thinner and thinner and thinner. Some language experts say the expression bite off more than you can chew came into use in the 19th century. At that time, some people chewed tobacco leaves. Some people, when offered tobacco, would take a big bite, a piece much bigger than they could chew. That may or may not be the origin, but in any event, when someone bites off more than they can chew, they promise themselves or others to do work they cannot complete. When using this expression, the reason you cannot complete the project is not important. Maybe you were already involved in too many other things. Maybe you didn't have the skills to finish the task. Or maybe you underestimated the time required to complete the job. Whatever the reason, it did not get done. Okay, now let's hear two friends use this expression. Steve and Michael are roommates. Steve is cooking in their first floor apartment, while running downstairs to the laundry room and writing a research paper. Michael watches as his very stressed-out roommate runs back and forth from one job to another. Finally, he asks Steve a question.
Steve, what is going on? You've been going nonstop all morning. And why are you running back and forth to the laundry room every 20 minutes? You don't have that many clothes.
I volunteer to do the laundry for older people in the building. You know, they can't make it down to the ground floor since the elevator broke.
And the cooking?
Oh, that. I promised to make treats for Sarah's birthday party this weekend.
That is so nice of you, but it shouldn't make you stressed. You love baking cookies.
I do, but with the holidays around the corner, I'm also super busy at work. Plus, my research paper for that online poetry class must be done in 3 days. I'm swamped.
You have bitten off more than you can chew. Again. When will you learn? There are only so many hours in a day. You just can't do it all.
I know. I just have a really hard time saying no.
Here, practice with me. I'm going to ask you to do me a favor, and you must answer no. Okay?
I'll try.
Hey, Steve, if you have some time tomorrow, I need help painting my bedroom. What do you say?
No.
Steve, just say no.
And that is all the time we have for this Words and Their Stories. But join us again next week when we investigate the story behind another word or expression. Until next time, I'm Ana Mateo.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. In the spring of 1865, the American Civil War was over, and the president who had led the Union during that war was dead. Abraham Lincoln had been murdered before the final surrender of Confederate forces. Now, the reunited nation had a new president, Andrew Johnson. He had been Lincoln's vice president. The Chief Justice of the United States swore Johnson into office a few hours after Lincoln's death. Most of Lincoln's cabinet was there, together with leading members of Congress. They looked to the new president with a mixture of shock and hope. Shep O'Neill and Tony Riggs begin the story of America's 17th president.
Andrew Johnson was, like Abraham Lincoln, a man of the people. He was born in North Carolina. His family was poor. There was no money or time for young Andrew to go to school. When he was 14 years old, his mother sent him to work for a tailor to learn to make clothes. Andrew worked hard. He opened his own tailoring business in the eastern part of the state of Tennessee. When he was 18, he married. His wife, Eliza, taught him to read and write.
Andrew became active in politics. At the age of 21, he was elected to the town council. 2 years later, he became mayor of the town. At 35, he won a seat in Congress in Washington. Next, he became governor of Tennessee. Then the state made him one of its two senators. The poor tailor boy was a success.
Andrew Johnson was a member of the Democratic Party. In the presidential election of 1860, he supported his party's candidate, not the candidate of the Republican Party, Abraham Lincoln. But Lincoln won the election, and as a result, Southern states carried out their earlier threat. They began leaving the Union to form their own nation. Johnson opposed this secession. He believed the South should remain part of the United States. He decided he had no choice but to support the Republican president. Most of the other citizens in Tennessee disagreed with him. They decided to leave the Union. Andrew Johnson had to flee his home to save his life. He returned only after Union forces took control of Tennessee and made him military governor.
President Lincoln noticed the man from Tennessee who supported the Union over the opposition of others. In 1864, Lincoln decided to run for re-election. He chose Johnson to be his vice presidential candidate. Lincoln hoped Johnson would win the support of Union-loving Democrats. He hoped Johnson would help heal the wounds between North and South. Now, Lincoln was dead, and Johnson was president. It was up to this little-known former tailor to make the decisions on Reconstruction, on rebuilding the Union. Johnson, not Lincoln, would decide if Reconstruction would be easy or hard. Johnson would choose if the North would punish the defeated rebel states or be merciful to them.
The radicals of Lincoln's Republican Party wanted severe Reconstruction. They said the South was a defeated enemy. They demanded strong punishment for all Southerners who took part in the rebellion. These radicals had disliked Lincoln's plans for Reconstruction. They felt he was too weak. Now, they hoped Johnson would share their ideas. They urged him to call a special session of Congress to pass strong legislation against the South. The radicals had reason to believe the new president agreed with them. He had called the rebels traitors. He had demanded strong action against them when the war ended. "The time has come," Johnson had said, "when the American people should understand what crime is, and that it should be punished."
But Andrew Johnson surprised the radicals. He did not call the special session of Congress. Instead, he announced his own program for the Southern states. Johnson declared a pardon for all former Confederates who promised to support the Union and obey laws against slavery. Then he permitted former officials of the Confederacy to run for office in their state's new elections. Many of these former rebels were elected. The radical Republicans were angry. They saw these elections as proof that the South had not really changed. They accused Johnson of being too soft. They urged him to punish the rebels. One radical newspaper wrote, "There is only one sure and safe policy for the immediate future. The North must remain the dictator of the Republic until the spirit of the North shall become the spirit of the whole country. The South's treason is still unpunished. Southerners cannot be trusted."
The radicals also worried about what would happen to the recently freed slaves. They said the new state governments of the South would not treat blacks as free and equal citizens. As proof, they pointed to new laws the Southern legislatures passed. For example, the state legislature in Mississippi said no black person could rent farmland. It said a black person needed special permission to work at any job except farming. Mississippi also passed a law saying a black person could be forced to work for a white man, usually his former owner, if he had no other job. Another way the state governments in the South acted against blacks was by refusing to give them the right to vote.
The radical Republicans decided that President Johnson's Reconstruction program must be stopped. They began working to get control of Congress, to pass their own program. Only by gaining political power could they punish the South and guarantee full political rights to former slaves. the radicals tried to take control in two ways. First, they refused to let many of the recently elected Southern congressmen take their seats when Congress opened. Then they formed their own Joint Committee on Reconstruction. This committee, not the Senate or the House of Representatives, would make many of the decisions about Reconstruction.
Radical lawmakers took other steps to seize control of Reconstruction efforts in the South. Congress had established a government agency to take care of black refugees in the South. The agency gave food and clothing to former slaves who had no food, money, or jobs. It began to teach them to read and write. Republicans in Congress moved to extend the life of the agency and increase its powers. They passed a bill and sent it to the White House for the president's approval. President Johnson vetoed the bill. He said it would create false hopes among former slaves. He also said it was unconstitutional. The radicals tried to overturn Johnson's veto. However, they failed to get the necessary votes.
Congress passed several other bills giving the federal government power to protect the rights of blacks in the southern states. President Johnson vetoed these bills, too. He said they interfered with the rights of the states. These defeats made the radicals even more angry. Their newspapers began a steady attack against the president and his policy toward the South. Some even accused him of treason.
Many Americans agreed with this criticism of President Johnson. They gave the radicals a big victory in congressional elections of 1866. Radical leaders gained the power to pass any bill they wished, even over the president's veto. And they wasted no time doing just that. Time after time, they voted to overturn Andrew Johnson's vetoes. The atmosphere in Washington became very tense. Relations between Congress and the White House sank to their lowest level in history. The political skies darkened. Soon, the storm broke. The radicals tried something that had never been tried before. They tried to remove the president from office. The conflict between the radicals and Andrew Johnson would provide some of the most historic and intense moments in American history. That will be our story in the next program of The Making of a Nation.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. And find more stories, quizzes, and English learning activities, including videos and lessons, on our website, learningenglish.voanews.com. Thank you for listening to The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.